the Soccer OG. Hey, that's me, Max Bretos. This is episode 145. As always, a reminder to rate, review, download, subscribe, and tell a friend. Important to change the cadence from time to time just to keep you guys on your toes. Rate, review, tell a friend, and share the word on our little podcast here that's spanning the globe. I apologize for the sound. You'll get used to it, but I'm recording from the work studio as opposed to the home studio. You know, sometimes you got to be a little bit mobile, but I won't miss a show because I love to talk to all of you. This week, where it's not the busiest, maybe one of the least busy weeks on the soccer calendar, and that's not saying there's nothing going on, but everything has just been packed since COVID, right? Non-stop fixtures news. But we do have a time to pause and look at what's happening with the U.S. men's national team. So Brian Shoretta, who's been with the show before and with America's Soccer Now, will join us to talk about all topics. He has some very interesting takes on the managerial and sporting director search, which I know a lot of people are getting very impatient about. But should we be a little more patient? And how much do we really know? Or and how much is U.S. soccer really telling us? Folarin Balogun. It would seem he's on his way to the U.S., but does the way that this have all rolled out give us any pause about the way England has viewed him, about what Balogun has said and what his goals really are, and does that mesh with life in CONCACAF? Hope to answer some of those questions in the business end. And then in stoppage time, I will talk about what was said by Kyle Larin. In passing, mind you, but he said it, so we're going to talk about it. He was asked after Canada-Honduras about the victory and where Canada stands, and he said we are the big boys of CONCACAF. Whether he meant singular or plural, doesn't matter. It's a good conversation to have, so we shall have it. Also, check out the Soccer OG on YouTube under my name, Max Bretos. We have a video on this very subject up there right now. It's time to get going, so let's go. Always looking forward to joining you here to talk about what happened in my week. I hope you guys had a great week. And it's been wonderful to be on the road with Major League Soccer and visiting old places you haven't been in a long time, seeing old faces, and just, you know, reconnecting with all things MLS. So this past weekend, I went to Toyota Stadium in Frisco, Texas for FC Dallas Portland. I would go to that stadium when it was just built or where it was prior at South Lake, Texas at Dragon Stadium. So, you know, that transition when FC Dallas was going to the Cotton Bowl to Toyota Stadium, or as it was known, Pizza Hut Park, I believe. And, you know, this was always a club that struggled with attendance. Well, the stadium, when it was open, didn't really hit the standard. It has some renovations. It has a Hall of Fame there now. Frisco was like a two-horse town, and now it's this bustling, gentrified area where there's everything you could want. So I get there. I go to a hotel. There's a mall next to it. It was Access. I had Chick-fil-A for lunch. I couldn't be happier. Go to my room, do my notes, make my phone calls. Really brand new hotel. As someone who's on the road, you don't ask for much more. You don't have time to see the city. You don't have time to really visit people or go sightseeing. Maybe once in a while, but you have to make an extra day. But if you're there the day before the game, you are in work mode because you just don't have time for it. So you kind of don't answer your phone. And people go, hey, man, let's go out. I go, no, I got to stay in my hotel. And you use that time to prepare. So when you have a mall next to you with food and you can just roll out there, that's an A+. Good to see all the folks at FC Dallas. And, you know, that place was full. And they always struggle with attendance. So they're doing something well there. It's an exciting team. And it's been, again, every week it gets better and better for me on the road, Major League Soccer. This week I will be in Seattle. I'm with Brian Dunseth. We are pumped because it is first and second place in the West. First place, St. Louis City, who lost. Visiting second place Seattle, who are on a tear. So you can see all of that on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Yeah, just sign up, man. Check it out. It's a good league. It's a good product, and it's going to continue to grow. But it's always nice to say you were there from the beginning, isn't it? We will get into the business end with Brian Shoretta to talk about everything. And more than, listen, I had the conversation already. There's even more on the meat on the bone than you could really imagine, in addition to just the main food groups, with regards to finding a sporting director or coach, the situation with Folarin Balogun, and what comes next. They just completed the Nations League. They have those semifinals on the horizon, and then they have this game against Mexico in April. Things are speeding up very quickly, and these months will fly by, and the Copa America will be here before you know it. The World Cup will be here before you know it. So there are some topics we will discuss. And in stoppage time, I will break down Kyle Larin's quote. It wasn't a misquote. People are going, oh, you're taking something out of context. No, he said what he said, and it's quite all right for him to say it. By saying the big boys of CONCACAF, and everyone's like, these alarm bells ringing. No, we're bringing it up because it's an interesting conversation. So I'm glad he said it. There's some truth to it. I love what CONCACAF Canada is doing. So there we go. And I will also say, I should save it for later. But the emergence of Canada is the best thing that's happened in CONCACAF in a decade or more. It's very good. Did you see this thing in the Premier League? 13 managers have been relieved of their duties this season. 13. There's 20 clubs. There were two let go on the same day. Graham Potter and... Brendan Rodgers. So two on the same day. By the way, Leicester's in second last place. If you look at... We know about the relegation. I know in theory it is... very exciting to think three of those teams that you're seeing there aren't going to be there tomorrow. That is exciting. And the high stakes, we know how high they are. But when you watch these relegation games, they're not good. So I think we get confused a bit and go, these are relegation games. They're better than ever. So if you're telling a neutral, hey, tune into West Ham Southampton, which is what I did because I'm a West Ham supporter. They're going to go, this game sucks because it did suck. And the relegation factor is a big reason why it sucked. I still think relegation promotion's the way to go. But let's be honest about the product. The quality play is not better. It's not this magic wand where everything gets better. I mean, there were some good games. The Crystal Palace game was a relegation six-pointer, and that lived up to it. But by and large, they're not. So we have, there's eight teams in the relegation challenge at this point. It is really tight. So you're going to see some dreck. But it'll all be worth it at the end. And again, this is not a shot against relegation promotion. I just think we have blurred the narrative a bit by saying it's this one-all, end-all that will fix American soccer. That's not true. People still like watching the big clubs. So I was always... Graham Potter, this is so interesting because even when he was leaving Brighton, as good as he was at Brighton, you were always saying to yourself... think about it from his perspective. He's getting to coach Chelsea. Yeah. A boyhood dream of managing, and now he's like, here I am. I don't know if it was a boyhood dream, but certainly it kicked in at some point. You want to manage the very best clubs. But there's no accident that these best managers are these tried, tested, leather-skinned, uncompromising personalities, which I don't think Graham Potter is. But he had to say yes to Chelsea. The smart move would have said, no, I got something good at Brighton. The way he was going, he probably could have had tenure for another 5 years. You have to go. The big money helps. And I think I was hearing somewhere else on another podcast that if he ran the duration of the contract, he was looking at $50 million. $50 million. He obviously didn't bring all of that in, but he does bring in a nice chunk, probably like $5, $6 million. And he should be okay on the other end of this. But I just found it fascinating because if it was me, I wouldn't have taken the Chelsea job because I knew this would have happened. That's too much... This is a me problem, but that's too much pressure for me. I don't want it. I want to be in a high-pressure profession. I don't want the highest pressure gig. I know that speaks volumes of me. But you give up a lot to take that, right? And look at Antonio Conte. You're like, man, you want to be like that? I don't think so. Even with guys like Pep Guardiola, it's hard work to keep that... had excellence, and the standards are through the roof because they gave him 6 months, even though he was handpicked by this Chelsea outfit. Now we're in a midweek. There's some games on Wednesday. I'm recording this on a Tuesday, and Chelsea drew again against Liverpool, so there's no shame, but they're not getting a lot of bang for the buck. What would be a success? Obviously, they win the Champions League, but they're not going to win the Champions League. There's too many good clubs, including the one they're playing, Real Madrid. And if they get by Real Madrid, it's Man City, Bayern. There's no way they're getting through there. So they're not going to be in the Champions League next year. And this has become a huge American story with Todd Boehly. And we defend our own, right? So even though Todd Boehly is this guy I have nothing in common with, he's a billionaire many times over, and he's in charge there. Because he's American, You know, I'm pulling for him, and it's interesting to see what's being said about him in England. I mean, he's getting the Glazer treatment nowadays, and I mean, I would say that's what he did is not the right way to build a club. You don't bring in $600 million worth of players, and you kind of bring in a manager, and you don't really align with it. You know, we all knew it was kind of probably going to blow up. It hasn't completely blown up, but the performance, especially in attack, with Mudrik and João Félix and Enzo Fernandez, not really an attacking player, but he gets up there, it's been poor, but we expected that. I hope it works out, though. But I have a feeling it probably won't, because let's face it, if it's not the wrong way that they've done it, this is the most unprecedented way possible. But there you have it. Chelsea, one of the things that are very interesting to talk about, one thing that's not as interesting to talk about, the Bundesliga, it looked like we had a race, but Bayern Munich quickly made meat of that and demolished Dortmund. I mean, they were up 2-3 goals the first half. Dortmund gave up the goal where the goalkeeper lets it go right under his foot. And this was a good moment for me to remind everyone, when you see stuff like that attached to Major League Soccer, you'll get a tweet, ha ha ha, only in Major League Soccer. The defending is so terrible. And it's just a reminder that this is happening everywhere. You know, it's easy to beat up Major League Soccer. But what happened to Gregor Kobel was pretty, I mean, that's as bad as it gets. He ran at the ball, swung and missed, and then Bayern Munich extend their lead, and it was over. That was classified a Kobel own goal, as it should have been. And Bayern win. They were up 4-0 and ended up 4-2. So, I mean, it was just a 2-point lead over Dortmund, 4-point lead over Union Berlin. It's over. Champions League is back next week. We'll get into that. Intriguing matchups. You got the hard side of the bracket. All due respect to our city, our friends. Okay, all due respect. You got the hard side of the bracket with Bayern, City, Real, Chelsea, and then you've got the forgiving side, which may not be the right choice of words, with Benfica and Inter and Milan-Napoli. And Milan-Napoli had a game over the weekend and looked good. So we don't want to get too... We don't want to spread ourselves too thin, but we wanted to get the main food groups out here on the Soccer OG. Let's get into the business. And Brian Sciarretta of American Soccer Now, as we roll up our sleeves about the U.S. men's national team. We are back now. Time for the business and a return guest here on the Soccer OG. Brian Sciarretta, the writer at American Soccer Now, who is our conduit in many ways. I know he's for me and for many of you guys out there as well, to Americans abroad. I love that. I love that expression. It's exactly what it is, Brian. We're following our Americans, which used to be one or two guys, and now we're dozens. I mean, do you ever stop and look? I go, man, this job's getting really difficult, because I got to watch 7 or 8 leagues. I got to watch 20, 30 teams. It's all consuming.
Yeah, you know, the whole landscape has changed. I mean, there was always a number of Americans abroad, even 15 years ago. But a lot of times you had to go to, like, you're covering, like, I don't know, Mönchengladbach U23 games or U19 games. And then eventually you realize that, like, this is, you know, the likelihood that they make it is very slim at that regard. Now it's just like, at least you're talking about first team players, which is, you know, makes it a lot interesting, and of course it all starts with MLS and the development here, because most of them now start here, move abroad, and they move to higher levels. They kind of move into the first team right away, and you have a familiarity with the players that they built up here. You know, it just makes it, like, everything. The pipeline's a lot more smooth and streamlined now, which is good.
Does MLS get to take some credit for that, because these players in many ways are ready to go when they go to Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything is really transformed, my coverage of MLS, I was always skeptical for, like, I would say maybe the first 15 years of the league, maybe around then. But when they started building their own academies, and then they started having homegrown signings, and everyone became more and more invested in those academies, I think it was a real turning point for like having more the number of American players. I really think, look, there was initially you had Yedlin and Miazga, those guys coming out of like academies, and then it just started. Then it spilled into Adams and Alphonso Davies, and and then all of a sudden it just kind of like really, skyrocketed since like 2017. Like around then, that's when Adams started to come in, and really, I guess since the last 6 years, it's been kind of really been the turning point but it's obviously the framework was laid earlier before that. But yeah, that's really what allowed Americans to really kind of succeed at a number of different levels, I think, in terms of getting them minutes here and not just shipping them off at very early ages into academies that Europe that were maybe weren't the best of fits, and developing close to home has huge advantages. And MLS also, well, most of the teams became more committed to playing young players and giving them first team minutes. And you play one or two seasons here, get 2,000, 2,500 minutes a season, then you move abroad, you get a transfer fee, you're going to get a shot with the first team pretty quickly, and you kind of see that.
That is I'm glad I brought it up, and it was because of something you said that, this is changing the landscape, and we don't want to send our players when they're not ready. We've seen that so many times in the past, and it still happens from time to time where they go over there and they get caught. I mean, I think of Brian Reynolds, who has fixed things in an incredible way, but he went to Roma as a young player, and he did have a time in MLS, but he just wasn't quite ready. And there's some guys who don't even make first team MLS in the past. So that pathway is obviously changing it. And by the way, I'm glad you brought up Borussia Mönchengladbach, because one of the new phenomenons is that we're having multiple Americans on a team. And that's why we follow Leeds. And that's why we watch Fulham. And now Mönchengladbach, this Brandon Vasquez rumor that I've been hearing, I don't know how firm it is. Perhaps there's an offer. But then you get him and Joe Scally. All of a sudden, we're having multiple teams with multiple Americans, which is a completely new thing that we haven't experienced. So the more the merrier, I would say. And there's guys
some clubs, they become more open to it. And they, when they start scouting the domestic side more regularly, they could develop a comfort level, and some teams have developed a comfort level with scouting over here more than others, but with Vasquez, I don't think there's an offer yet, but I don't really like to report on quote unquote interest or someone's on the radar, because that could mean like anything in the world. But look, I mean,
it seems like a good fit.
Yeah, Mönchengladbach sent their sporting director, not a scout, not just a liaison, but their sporting director traveled from Germany to the United States to watch him play, in Nashville, and he ended up scoring the winner in a 1-0 game. That's a little more serious than most other kind of reports, when you can report like a sporting director making a transatlantic flight from Germany. So, yeah, I think, he only has one goal so far this season, but Cincinnati's still playing well. I think he just, needs to, these next 2 months are going to be important for him. And if he continues to do well and he gets the call up, which I'm expecting, if not the U.S., then Mexico in a couple weeks when they play in Arizona, and he has a good international showing, I think he's in a good spot, to potentially get offers. Now, the question is what does Cincinnati value Emma? What do they sell? And if they also sell Brenner, are they going to be willing to sell?
Yeah, they're left with nothing all of a sudden. They got to worry about their own fortunes.
I think a lot of these teams are going to try to do what like some of these other teams have done, like, for example, New England and Tejan Buchanan, and where they sell them, and they, or Gaga Slonina with Chicago, where you sell them in the summer and they get loaned back initially through the end of the year. That's the only way I can see Cincinnati being willing to part with both of those players, or sell both of them. They can't both leave the club for good in the summer. I mean, they have too much at stake, too much invested for that to really be the case.
Yeah, I was surprised that they were able to keep that club intact ahead of the MLS season, because of what you said with Brenner and Brandon Vasquez. There was the Chivas connection, but they're there. We'll see how long they can keep them. But by the way, this summer, heading into the summer transfer with players going in and out of Major League Soccer, that is going to be fascinating, because I know the league needs to bolster some of the star power and some of the elite players they have, and those that want to go to Europe. We're going to see it. That's going to be fun to cover in detail. And you also mentioned about Mönchengladbach sending their sporting director, and it reminded me of a question I wanted to ask you. And by the way, the relationships between clubs, you know, I'm here at LAFC and they have a new budding relationship with Bayern Munich. All that helps in the big picture. But you mentioned sporting director and the U.S. men's national team doesn't have one. I was telling people on this program, it's okay, be patient. But now we're in April and I'm starting to, and I know they said we want it by the Women's World Cup. You're starting to get a little impatient because you want some sort of pathway towards that. Do you share that impatience? What do you think about that timetable for the U.S. soccer and setting that, and obviously getting that position in place so that they can determine who the next, or if the Greg Berhalter will retain that position as the head coach?
Yeah, I think, you know, as soon as you start to accept that Hudson will probably be leading the Gold Cup and the Nations League through June, you know, it becomes, you know, just having the infrastructure set up by the fall, you know, and then, which would then pretty much start the 9 or 10 month lead up to the Copa America, which is the first big milestone. This team will play this cycle, probably the most important one before the World Cup. You know, it kind of starts to make sense. I mean, I think that they think, you know, I don't think Hudson's not a long-term solution, but I think there's probably a little bit of comfort level there between him and the players. I mean, the players go back with Hudson, you know, as an assistant for several years now, and they like him personally. So I think they want to do it right. It comes down to who they've identified, and not everyone they've identified or they wanted to interview was interested in the job. So, you know, then it becomes a little more complicated, and not everyone that's approached them, I don't know how interested they are, you know. And then there's also another complexity, whereas if they're interviewing people, are the people, what's the deal with the contract of their current existing job? Because I'm sure that some people that they're interviewing are probably currently employed. So maybe under contract. So, and typically those things, if they're in Europe, they run through seasons, and giving up anybody, you know, at this juncture is tough. You know, all that's very hush hush. They've done a good job, you know, keeping things quiet, but I kind of never really expected anything to get done before the end of the European season. Cause if they're going to try to speak to everyone that they wanted to speak to, you know, the chances are not everyone's going to be free before then. So, you know, the problem is you don't want to go too late into the summer, because then all of a sudden, if they go too far into the summer, you know, coaches get hired up real quickly in the beginning of summers, because there's a lot of managerial changes in like May and June. And then usually by the end of June, everyone's taken because everyone's prepared for the current season. And
of course,
so, you know, I'm sure that they're not doing nothing, but the fact that they're keeping it hush hush, I think, so well, has kind of kept everything, made more people kind of anxious and stuff. But I don't know. I think they'll be fine. I don't really get the sense of urgency too much, because I always figured Hudson was going to be there through the summer. Then it's just going to be friendlies for about 10 months.
Yeah, and I think that's fair enough. If they want to get some of these European based candidates, and you know, the talk about what you would have to pay, and people have these crazy dream lists of Jose Mourinho and Thierry Henry, and there was that Zinedine Zidane report a few months ago.
Yeah,
but then they're gonna have to pay these guys, and I don't know if that's they want to pay. And I'd be
honest. There's the budget, and there's you know, and it's it comes down to how serious some of those interests are, and how much, what exactly are the requirements of the sporting director? We know what the requirements of the head coach are, but the sporting director, like how, if you're going to be appointing youth coaches and stuff, like, and the Olympic coach and all these other things, like what familiarity do you have to have with, like, you know, the existing market in U.S. soccer, and kind of, you don't have to be American, but, you know, do you just walk into this job cold without knowing the landscape of everything here? Yeah, it's different, you know, it's tough to envision a scenario where both the head coach and the sporting director have had no real ties with American soccer.
Yeah, agreed. It's such a unique circumstance, our game out here too. And you need some sort of, if you don't have that background, you need someone alongside you shoulder to shoulder that can kind of show you along the way, whether that's the sporting director, whether that's the coach. I would also say, you know, you might have a good candidate in MLS, been covering the league. Maybe there's some guys who have that American know-how who are already within the league. That's what they did last time with Greg Berhalter, but we just don't know. It's hush-hush, which I think it's a bit of a cold comfort in that sense that you don't know what's going on. You get frustrated, but by and large, you know that they're, as you said, they're doing something, and we are just maybe not privy to it. And that's part and parcel with soccer federations everywhere. We don't really know how the sausages are being made, et cetera. But maybe it's Anthony Hudson. And I really enjoyed him in these press conferences. I've enjoyed what he has been able to do incorporating players. He's really been that one sort of beacon that we've had as a connection for positive things that have happened. And I think cap tying guys are at the top of the list, not giving him all the credit, but it happened under his watch with Alejandro Sendejas and Johnny Cardoso. And I guess it was Taylor Booth too, because he had like an Italian connection. Not that he was going to go play.
Yeah,
right?
He was Italian citizen. I mean, I don't know
how that's something.
The degree of interest some of these guys had with various countries. I mean, I know with Zendejas, the process to bringing him on board was lengthy. It went back to Berhalter last year. But look, I mean, you know, it's good to get people involved. I like with Hudson, you know, when things are kind of up in the air and there's a lot of things people talking about, you know, things like the Reyna's and all this other stuff. And, you know, he's a positive face to put he's a good caretaker in that regard. You can kind of keep the ship going be positive. And I think the players like him. I think the players like,
oh, you can tell
the players like the whole staff, you know? And I think if they realize that, you know, it's not a surprise if Greg's not there, they at least know, well, Hudson is going to be kind of what to expect from Hudson. It's not going to be dour. You have a guy backstabbing people, trying to get the job himself. He's pretty honest in that regard. And I think it's kind of like Sarakin was in a way, you know, when he was the interim. He took over during a time of turmoil and just kind of was he had an objective of just flushing out the last generation and bringing in the new guys en masse. It came at the expense of building a cohesive unit, but he got a lot of the guys used to coming in together and playing. Yeah, and it paid off. And from there, Greg Berhalter built on it, but like at least Sarakin was calling these guys up and getting them used to each other. You know, I think with Hudson, it's just a little different. You know, these guys all know each other. So he's just trying to more or less keep the system going. And now he's actually, unlike Sarakin, he's going to have to play some competitive games. With that being said, we'll see how it goes. It's going to be interesting this summer. And he has big shoes to fill because the U.S. team has had a lot of success in CONCACAF. But, I think just generally I get a positive vibe from the environment that these that he's put together. I mean, handling the Reyna thing was not an easy task, but you know, he seems to be working through it.
Yeah, and he made Gio very whole in these Nation League games in the month of March, which again, you would think is an easy flip of the switch, but it's not. And you've got to get the guys to buy in. You have to work on Gio Reyna, but you have to work on the group, and it seemed pretty seamless. So there's a lot of things that Anthony Hudson has done that you've got to be really pleased about when we're perhaps getting a bit impatient with what is happening. And by the way, I spoke to Nico Estevez because I did the FC Dallas game and I asked him about Greg Berhalter. And I know Greg Berhalter gets he does get much more criticism than he should. Nico Estevez waxed poetic about how Berhalter prepared him for coaching in FC Dallas, about managing players, about every aspect that he wasn't even aware of in big game management. And Nico Estevez, I mean, I asked the question thinking he was, oh yeah, it was great. He went into detail about, you know, this is a guy who was with Valencia, who coached Valencia for a brief moment. He talked about how Greg Berhalter taught him new things about keeping in touch with players, making these phone calls when you wouldn't expect it, or just looking at stuff that you may overlook. And he even said that himself. So I look at Greg Berhalter and you look at the things that the people that were under him, and now Anthony Hudson is connected to that. And we've got to give Greg Berhalter some of that credit with beginning that that progress with dual nationals, which in recent years also you include Ricardo Pepi, and now we have Villar and Balogun. And if that happens under Anthony Hudson's watch, then it would be hard. I mean, people will be screaming, oh, we want Anthony Hudson considered for the full-time job. Not that it's going to happen, but that is, you know, that one piece, because we don't have a consistent striker, although Ricardo Pepi is starting to shape into that, it would appear. But Villar and Balogun, who all signs seem to point, Brian, that he's headed to the U.S., there's little hints with like maybe follow. I saw one today on a Twitter handle, I think USMNT only, saying he's started following Christian Pulisic, or he stopped following the England national team squads. And again, we can't look too far into that. But he was in Orlando, obviously. He was at a Magic game. So it would seem that that is the next big happening for the U.S. whenever that happens. And I don't think he's in any rush at this point. But what do you think about that? You've seen this guy emerge. He's been fantastic. But what are the positives, and what are some of the challenges we would have to face if, in fact, Balogun swears his allegiance to the United States?
Yeah, it's an interesting I don't like the term recruitment. You know, it should be people following where they want to play. I've kind of become a believer that, like, unless a player really, really wants to play for that national team, like, he's never going to live up to, you know, what you see on a club level. And that's never going to translate fully to the national team unless, like, it's a place that he really wants to be. You know, we've seen that in a couple. I mean, Timothy Chandler kind of jumps out at your mind, you know, but yeah. Like, you know, he had a nice club career, but it never really translated very well. You know, and it was he was committing, he was in and out of the team, you know, various managers had difficulties bringing him in. While he was still playing in the Bundesliga on a weekly basis, he's older now, but, like, you know, you see those kind of things and you always have to wonder whether or not it's going to translate over. I think this is what makes it so different, is this is not really a recruitment. This is a referendum on how he feels with England, because the U.S. doesn't really have a vision to sell him. Like, you know, usually you sell the people on, this is where we're going, this is what direction we're going. And the U.S. can't really do that without a sporting director and a permanent head coach to offer that vision, because, you know, those people who are speaking to him now on behalf of the U.S. don't really have ownership of that direction. I mean, he could speak to the players and get a sense of the vibes that are involved with camp, but that's not, you know, that's different. I think England is behaving very oddly for this. Look, I mean, he's on the pace to score 20 goals and over 20 goals in Ligue 1. And you think that even among the elite teams, a guy who's scoring that many goals in a top league is going to have access to his country's national team head coach. Even if that's not good enough for a call-up, it might not be for top national teams, but you'd at least be in the pool and talking to players and talking to coaches and meeting with coaches whenever you wanted to, because, you know, there's a little bit of respect that comes along with doing what he's doing. But look, England's supposed to be meeting with him this week, and they're sending the U21 coach to try to convince him to stay. This is the kind of thing that, like, you think Southgate would just, you know, at least travel just out of respect, saying, like, look, you're on the verge, if you're not there yet, but at least we respect with what you're doing. I mean, what he's doing normally would put him in the pool just about every other national team. So it's weird. You know, and you see the quotes from him saying, like, I want to play in front of millions of people and stuff like that. And, you know, that's, I don't know if that's what everyone wants to hear. You know, maybe he's being too honest. Maybe he's not selling the right things. I don't know. You think he's got enough talent to really help the U.S. team, but this is weird because, like, it almost seems like he's just walking away from England more than joining the U.S. He never got that sense with Dest, because, you know, he played with the U.S. at all these youth competitions, and he just kind of stayed with the U.S. And, you know, Unas Musa, you know, he lived for the first 9 years of his life in Italy. Then he moved to Spain when he was like 15, 16. You know, England was kind of like just a period of his life, whereas Balogun is very much London to the core. And you know,
that's no so minor detail,
it's
man.
Weird.
Yeah, it's
a very weird situation. I've never seen a it becoming like a referendum on like just walking away from a country versus joining it.
It's gotten weirder by the minute. And like at first, when you hear it, we're all excited because A, we need a striker, and we haven't seen a guy like this who's scoring. You know, the French league is a top league. And he is right there. I don't. He was third. He was first for a minute, but he's there in the top five. And Kylian Mbappe, Jonathan David lead the way. But this is a rare opportunity at a striker. And you're just watching him play, he pops off the screen. You're like, wow. But all that noise around him has to give us pause. I don't know if it has just yet, and I don't know how that will manifest itself. Not only, as you said, for a player who may be putting himself in a position where he doesn't have these options, as we've seen with England and some of the things I've heard from Gareth Southgate. I love the honesty that he shared, and he was very upfront. And he goes, look, just because we want to cap tie, I mean, we don't just cap tie people to cap tie. And I said, that's a great approach. So, that I mean, that's the way it should be. And the fact that they are not rushing in, because again, they have great options, but they don't, you know, a younger 21-year-old striker, like this, or 20, I may have got the age 21, wrong.
Yeah,
21. They have guys a little bit advanced there. They don't really have one in that sweet spot. And I know they're bringing in Ivan Toney, who's a little bit older, and Harry Kane's up there, Bukayo Saka, Marcus Rashford, a lot of options. So they don't have to rush in for that. But I figured there'd be a little bit more a massaging of that as opposed to what we have seen, which you pointed out. And then the other point about, are you ready for life in this U.S. soccer? And as excited as people are, how does the rest of the squad approach it when he is taking the field in Central America? As well, I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, I mean,
I've never seen this.
He says he wants to play in front of millions of people, and like that might be true at like the World Cup and the Copa America, which the Copa America is a one-off, by the way. I mean, most of the games are like, you know, sometimes you're playing in front of 15,000 people in Columbus, or you're playing you know, at a muddy field in El Salvador, and you got to show up for those games. You got to put your heart into those games. You know, it's not most of what the U.S. national team does is not glamorous. Now, for fans, that 10% is great.
We're used to it.
10% is great, but like these CONCACAF Nations League, like, yeah, I mean, no, I don't think that's ever really caught on big time. It's just it's a weird thing, and like, again, it's just like you wonder why is he joining? He's not really joining the U.S. He's walking away from England, and it's like, oh man, like
semantics, yes,
it is different. And then, you know, like, and it's going to be then up to him to win over the U.S. locker room, because I mean, I think the U.S. locker room, you know, I think they like Ricardo Pepi, I think they like Josh Sargent, I think they like Daryl DK. And when he comes in, one of those guys isn't going to get called up, you know, and they have to like him too. But that's the same way. That's just part of being a team, right? You know, that's part of being a team in any sport, in any league. You know, you have to win over the locker room when you're joining a well-oiled machine that's kind of well-established and the core's been together. So we'll see. It's going to be interesting to see how it all comes together. It's far different than any other kind of dual national situation I've ever seen, though. Just by the, you know, you remember Berhalter and Stewart meeting with Musa and meeting with and having these long extended dialogues with Dest, and you know, but now it's like it's just weird to have like interim staff kind of leading the way here. You know, and then him showing up at Magic games, and it's very, very different.
I agree, and I think the U.S. would be smart. You can't just, if they win these Balogun sweepstakes, not to promise him the world. And I don't think they would. They don't do that. But you have to make it attractive, but to a degree. And I think they'll be pretty stern with him. But it looks like Balogun might be in a weird situation where his options may be thinned out. The other one is Nigeria, where clearly he's going to play behind Victor Osimhen. And there's a lot of other good Nigerian strikers, but you would like to think that he could break through and be considered for England or Nigeria. But if that may not be the case, then he comes to the U.S. And I look, we don't want to dampen the enthusiasm, because the idea that Balogun may came here was like a a trending topic. I mean, it was my number one on my Twitter. It was like Balogun, and everyone was following him, and it was exciting. But now the reality sets in. It's just not a flick of the switch, and this guy scores 50 goals for the U.S. and his career. But it's challenging. And as I said, what is the perception of guys like Ricardo Pepi and Josh Sargent and Daryl Dike, who are putting this work in and want that gig? In particular, Pepi, who was so impressive in this last window.
They already have the ties with the team, you know?
Yes, exactly.
You know, there's those bonds are there, and then the bonds get
settled. As you said, you know?
And that's okay. I mean, normally, no one's ever meant to have a spot on the national team for good and cement it in. Like, someone's always aiming to take their place, and that's just the way of the world. But, like, you know, but there's a process for that. So, you know, we'll see. It's just very interesting to see how this goes. And I still think there's some more twists and turns ahead of us before we see how it goes. And then if he does commit, then it's the whole integrating him in and trying to make sure like that Ligue 1 form that he has translates over to the national team. So, and there's no guarantee with that either. So
we've just poo-pooed on this whole thing, Brian.
No, I don't mean to do it. He's obviously an amazing player, but
Brian,
I
think it's important to have this conversation because it's not easy for that transition. It gets sticky and there's a lot of parts involved. So, what can you do? If he wants to play in front of a huge crowd, he'd have a good chance if he swore allegiance ahead of the Nations League semifinals. That'll be in June. And in Las Vegas, it'll be USA-Mexico. So that's going to be a huge draw. And then the final would be against Canada-Panama if the United States advance out of there. And I don't think it probably doesn't happen that quickly. I mean, that June's going to be here in an instant. But what are your thoughts on this Nations League? I know it happened 2 years ago, and I had my enthusiasm, I kept it low, but I went there to Denver, and when I watched it and was part of it, I was like, this is amazing. This was much better than I thought. 2 years later, you have a much better Canada team, and it's a good schedule in an off year where you have Gold Cup, but you don't have the Copa America, and then obviously you don't have the World Cup. It's a quick little tournament, and you have a chance where the U.S. will play Mexico and possibly Canada. Sign me up. You know, that is like the new world order in CONCACAF. Is it getting you excited, the prospects of that tournament coming up in a couple months?
I mean, I think, you know, two Gold Cups and two Nations Leagues between every World Cup, and also planning with a World Cup qualifying. I know the U.S. is not in it this time, but, like, that'll be the normal procedure. So if we're dealing with World Cup qualifying and two Gold Cups and two Nations Leagues, every 4 years, that's a lot of CONCACAF. I mean, I think it's...
That's a good t-shirt. That's a lot of CONCACAF.
Yeah, that is a lot of CONCACAF. I mean, and it's tough to really get excited for. Like, I think, you know, as these cycles go on and this becomes the run of the mill. Look, I don't think people were really excited about winning the Nations League. They were just excited. The American fans were just excited about beating Mexico.
Fair.
And that rivalry kind of carries the day. Whereas, like, people want to win the Copa America. People want to win, you know, like a lot of these other regional championships. But CONCACAF, you know, they just kind of rely on the U.S.-Mexico rivalry carrying the day. You know, an improved Canada team helps, you know, and then that's coming in as kind of Costa Rica's coming back down to earth and everything. But, like, you have these two tournaments now every summer, and it's just, I don't know. I think CONCACAF and the U.S. soccer, I don't know what the plan is going forward, but if there's no real tests outside of this region,
it's a problem.
They have to make this Copa America thing like a regular kind of occurrence. And that's tricky.
That's out of your hands too.
Yeah. And then if you go as a guest team, you can't bring your best players and you're at the mercy of clubs. You're probably sending in just like reserves, the third and fourth stringers. It's not a good situation. So I don't know. I think they set themselves up nicely this cycle, but I don't know what the plan is. I don't mean to poo-poo everyone who's getting excited, who's got Nations League fever, but I just said, like, this is, we've had, you know, we're drunk on CONCACAF right now at the moment.
Well, it's a problem, man. And that's why I said the Europeans are running away from us, because they can have a Nations League and they have the infrastructure in place, and they have 20 powerhouse countries that anyone can play.
48 teams. They have, like, you have tiers of excellent, unbelievable, and very good and okay teams, and just only a few bad ones. It's whereas this region is, it's mostly bad, except for, like, you know, a couple teams that only really have the ability to qualify for the World Cup. But when everyone gets one vote, you know, not everyone has the same interests aligned, because some of these small countries, they don't care about qualifying for the World Cup, and they never will. So it becomes like, you know, how much money can they get for having these kind of events and stuff like that. And, you know, it's a bit of a big problem right now, that goes way higher up than the U.S. national team, you know, and you hope that they can figure it out, because, you know, you just don't want, like, it's just a big problem that I think affects the U.S. national team, as to how to keep it relevant between World Cups on a regular basis, not just hope for like this is the second time we're going to have the Copa America. Once was the Centenario, now we have this one. You know, you got to kind of, these things kind of fall into your lap, but you need to have something kind of consistent. Used to be the Confederations Cup. That was always a good one. And then they scrapped that. So, you know, it's the options have become more narrow. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. I think there will be one. I'm kind of an optimistic in that regard, whether it be a global nations league or another kind of tournament. But again, you know, you just need to have the national team, you know, be relevant between World Cups, you know, and that's another part of the vision of this program that I think is big picture critical.
And no one's really looking out for us. Everyone's looking out for themselves in the big picture. And there is the hope that maybe you can align with South America. And as you said, the Copa America is coming up in 2024, but that was a huge ordeal. I was talking to people in South America that said that was a done deal like a year and a half ago. They were trying to sell it, but it was only confirmed to us that it was going to happen here just a few months ago. So
and they're doing it at the club level too, Max, you know, like they're going to start this tournament that it has like the Libertadores semifinalists and the CONCACAF Champions League semifinalists, which will be MLS and Liga MX teams probably. And, you know, and I mean, joining the Libertadores is tough full time because it's more travel than it would be to Europe. But I think, you know, South America offers the best opportunity for the U.S. With Europe kind of its own powerful bubble there, and South America, you know, while it is further away than Europe for many of parts, you know, still has incredible talent, and the U.S. can provide infrastructure and all this other stuff, you know, when they can host these things. Same thing with Mexico. So again. They're doing these things and I'm optimistic, but it's going to take a lot of thought.
And we'll have to give, it's kind of like, I believe it's like you're at the table and North America says, hey, we'd love the Copa America. And they go, okay, what do you have for us? And what can South America benefit with? And obviously a relationship with USA and Mexico is very appealing. The rest of CONCACAF, I don't think South America is doing backflips to align with that. And that's,
well, I mean, look,
too,
I mean,
everyone
look,
wants
I
to have mean, the power.
Look, South America cut out like parts of their continent and gave them to CONCACAF, you know, because they didn't
want
it.
That's so true. They go, you can have Suriname. I mean, and
you're right. Exactly. You know, it's like, you know, but the thing with South America, why it's a better run federation is because everyone there in South America, while like a team like Venezuela and, you know, in Bolivia are long shots to qualify for the World Cup, at least it's still possible. So they still have an interest in like, you know, ensuring quality competitions and everything. And like, where in CONCACAF, it's just, there's no, interests are so far aligned. You know, Mexico has, and US and Canada have nothing in common with a lot of big swaths of the Caribbean. And, you know, and that allows like, you know, corruption to kind of pop up. You know, and you know, when, because there's no binding of interests. So I don't know. I think that's where, you know, the U.S. needs to be in a place where more people are aligned with their interests than are not.
Brian, as I figured would be the case, we've got so much ground to cover still, and we probably don't have enough time. But I did want to ask you about the under 20 World Cup, which was supposed to be in Indonesia, and it was a good segue because it's going to be, it looks like, in Argentina, which again we're going to see this odd just alignment, and it's not the ideal real partner to in on short notice. I always think if you have a tournament in short notice, like what happened as they got it gets pulled, give it to the United States because they're ready to go. No questions asked, no problems. It's not that simple, but certainly it's possible. Anyway, the U.S. are in there. It's a very strong U.S. team. They look really good in qualifying. We know our kids are getting better. And I mean, how good do you think that performance can be? And again, they moved ahead of Mexico, which that was their baby, these under 20s and under 17s. And the U.S. have also qualified for the Olympics. Mexico hadn't. But how good do you think this under 20 effort can go with a new host country overseeing it?
I think they can be very good. I think it comes down to having a couple of players released. You know, it becomes tricky because clubs are never required to release players for youth tournaments. And unfortunately, with the timing of the Qatar World Cup, it pushed the European seasons later. And now all of a sudden, there's a big overlap between the U20 World Cup and the end of these European seasons. So teams are going to be forced to let these players go and miss meaningful games. Not everyone is going to be willing to do that. I think they'll still get most of the players, if not all of them, from MLS teams in Europe. You know, it comes down to, you know, they need to get, if they're going to need some big hits though. Like they need to get Kevin Paredes released. They're going to have Dan Edelman is the defensive midfielder. He's the captain of the team, but there's no suitable backup for him, so he becomes very, very critical. So they're thin in some spots where they could struggle. But I think overall, you know, you like where some of these players are at. They have some players who can be impact players. Paxton Aronson, I think, is good. Brian Gutierrez at Chicago, I think, is very good. Edelman. So it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to seeing this team. And, I think that they've upgraded in a lot of places from qualifying, like Owen Wolf. Is now with the team and he's doing very well for Austin. But yeah, I think it comes down to releasing. And if they get a good number, a couple key players here and there, and they get a good draw, I think they're going to the knockouts. And I think that they got a good shot to advance again.
That is very exciting. I put my arms up. You can't see it because it's audio. I put my arms up because I was really excited. And my camera on my laptop thought I was going to ask you a question, so I had to put my hands back down.
I thought you were telling me to stop.
No, I had to put my hands down really quickly because I don't want to stop the interview. But I think that's a great point. I mean, we haven't won one of these big tournaments on the youth level. We've done great in the groups, and then we always flame out. But maybe this is different. It feels like it's different.
I don't know. You know, and if they go to the semis, you know, and they don't win the whole thing, I don't think it's like a Roman emperor thumbs up, thumbs down. I think
that'd be an interesting way for our sport to go.
Still pretty good. I mean, you know, getting to the quarterfinals time after time after again reaps its own rewards, and they've had a pretty good, they had an excellent turnover of sending players to the full national team. Now all of a sudden you get this other link in the chain with the Olympics, and now it's like it's a real pipeline, I think, to getting people prepared for that full first, you know, getting people on the full national team. I think it's a good team. I like the players, and I think it's there are some holes, there are some concerns, but you know, who isn't excited to see Caleb Wiley? I mean, he's been one of the best players in the league, and having a left side with him and Kevin Paredes on one side, I mean, that's very good. You know, it's and Gaga Slonina in goal. I mean, they have some pieces. They don't have a nine. They only have one defensive midfielder. So there are concerns, but other than that, you know, I think it's an interesting team. It's fun to watch.
All part of a very exciting calendar over the next 3 years, really, for the U.S. And if you want to be well prepared, you got to follow Brian Sciarretta on his social media handles and American Soccer Now. It's a great resource. So that, you know, what's great about it is that you can find out who the next great player. Brian will steer you in the right direction. He's done that for me many times over the past few years. Great to catch up with you, Brian. I know we have there's a lot of other things to talk about, but maybe we can circle back and do that later in 2023.
Anytime, Max. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Brian. We'll be back with Stoppage Time. We'll talk about the thoughts of Kyle Larin and whether Canada is the big boys, the Giants of CONCACAF. That's next here on the Soccer OG in Stoppage Time. Time now for Stoppage Time, and there was something, and again, the audio, I know it's a little metallic. Deal with it. We'll get through here, but appreciate you guys tuning in. And this past week, after the Nations League international dates, we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but Kyle Lowry was interviewed. He scored 2 goals against Honduras. Canada wins 4-1. They win their group. They head to the Nations League semifinals. They're actually seeded there, finished ahead of Mexico, which means they avoid the United States and Mexico in the semifinals. Fantastic work, again, by this Canadian national team. And he was interviewed afterwards, and it wasn't really out of context, because some people said it was. It really wasn't. He goes, "Where are the big boys of CONCACAF?" Which is certainly fine on the surface. And A, he's not completely wrong, and it's worth having a discussion. B, he can talk it up, man. Kyle Lahren's been fantastic, not only scoring for country, but for club. He's on loan at Valladolid. He has a handful of goals, which is keeping them just above the relegation picture. I mean, that is a relegation picture I'm curious to tune into. Maybe it provides, you know, we always focus it on the Premier League, but, you know, the relegation in every country can be as glorious and as disappointing, right? So Kyle Lahren can talk the talk, as can Canada. And while I don't think they are the big boy of CONCACAF, they're certainly amongst the big boys. But they might be ahead of Mexico. The United States may be a ship too far. But Canada, there's enough positive things that you can say about them. And I'd like to say hello to our Canadian listeners. And I hope you enjoyed Sid Sechero a few weeks ago. We're going to try and keep abreast of all things Canada. But this Canadian team have a reason to say it. Now, it's going to have to be results-driven, and we won't really know the answer to this question until the end of this cycle at the 2026 World Cup, where the United States is co-hosting with Canada. But just with the talent, Canada can compete. They don't have the depth. They don't have the ceiling, because Canada, population-wise, it's a big country, but population-wise, it's not, compared to the United States and Mexico in particular. It's a big, big gap. They have done a wonderful thing infrastructure-wise, because you just have to look. I don't know. I'm not an expert on all things Canada, but I'm just telling you what I see and how I know, once you see enough of these signs, that there's something going on well. Let's start with the immigration. Canada, with a much more lenient open door to immigrants, making their dreams come true. That's how Alphonso Davies and Jonathan Davies became it. There's a long list of athletes kind of following suit, and Ismael Kone that Canada's benefiting from. And they're not doing it to benefit in soccer. It's a policy I wish the United States was a little closer to. We don't have to have as open a immigration policy, but a little more open, so we don't have how it is the situation we have right now. So that's going to help them. And then you see how it's helping them. It's not just soccer. It's basketball. You know, we always hear Canada, hockey, 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 hockey. Well, they put together, you know, a lot of good players, and Jamal Murray and RJ Barrett, you know, top NBA players, and starting to do better on the international stage. So, you know, we know basketball is an indoor sport, but, you know, soccer in Canada is an indoor sport as well. I mean, they a lot train indoors, and they get the right practices. And we've seen with some of these academies, Toronto FC, a good example. They haven't developed the great, great prospects, but they're getting there. They're probing around. And Montreal with Kone, they just developed him. Vancouver's going to have some of those guys. Maybe you heard of Alphonso Davies. You know, it's these guys are out there. So there's a participation number going on in Canada. They're doing something. I don't know what exactly, but when the basketball and soccer rises at the same time, you know, athletics are being taken to another level north of the border. The talent has been better, and while across the field I like the U.S. better and probably Mexico better, from the attacking midfield up, I think I would take Canada. I mean, they have the best striker in CONCACAF in Jonathan David, who is, I believe, tied for first in goal scoring in Ligue 1 with Kylian Mbappe. That's more than we were going crazy about Folar and Balogun, but he is off the pace there. And David's been doing this consistently with Lille. They have the best player in CONCACAF in Alphonso Davies. Saw him with Bayern this weekend. He looks as dominant as ever. Some other pieces around there have all done very well. Tejan Buchanan, Ismael Kone,
appearing regularly with Watford. Alistair Johnson goes to Celtic. He's a fullback, and he looks comfortable more and more. Of course, Kyle Larin as well. Steven Eustachio, everyday player. He's just 26. He's an everyday player for Porto. So everyone from there up, I kind of like better than the USA and Mexico. From the back, not as much. Canada has to find defenders. Their best defenders are Atiba Hutchinson, who's way past his prime. Derek Cornelius is okay. He's a good defender, but that can't compete. Certainly in the United States, where they have like five or six really top-tier center backs now. Miles Robinson returning. Tim Ream, one of the top defenders in the Premier League. Chris Richards, Cameron Carter-Vickers, Mark McKenzie, all these guys with high ceilings, Walker Zimmerman, and there's more. Canada can't compete with that, can't really compete with fullbacks, but the better all-around team is that. Now, Canada also won the World Cup qualifying, so as with regards to being the bull of the woods, they are the bull of the woods as it stands right now. At the World Cup, they performed the poorest of the four teams, close with Costa Rica. But USA were number one. Easy to determine that. They made the round of 16. I would have said Canada was third out of four teams. You know, they didn't get any points. Everyone else got something. I think they were ranked 31st out of 32 teams, Canada. But they ended up playing in the most difficult group. They were in a group with Belgium, Croatia, and Morocco. We didn't know it at the time, but that was the toughest group. Belgium's Belgium. And they got knocked out by Croatia and Morocco, who both made the semifinals. And Canada should have beaten Belgium and lost to Morocco 2-1. So there's a lot of data there that says what Kyle Larin said isn't far-fetched. And I'm glad he said it because we need this. Again, Canada emergence these last 2 years is the best thing to happen in CONCACAF in a decade, if not longer. Because as we talked to Brian about it, you heard him say it. When we have a lot of CONCACAF fixtures, we can't compete with Europe. We can't compete with South America if we're playing each other. But if that's the way it's going to be, we better have better natural rivals. And Canada's become one. So instead of having that one really big game against Mexico, maybe a game here against Costa Rica and Honduras, maybe, you know you're going to get a big game against Canada for the foreseeable future. So it's all good on the big picture. And yeah, let's talk some trash. Let's excite this up, man. We don't have to be so polite. That Canadian team's not polite. That's part of the reason I like them. We don't have to be polite. So let's go. Of course, June 15th, the Nations League semifinals. It's going to be USA-Mexico. And Canada plays Panama. So a good chance to get a dream. You get USA-Mexico. And then you can get the bonus USA-Canada on June the 18th. The games are in Las Vegas. It's going to look amazing. So there you go. I mean, it's still the Nations League. But that should be exciting. You know, for the neutrals, for the diehards, and look forward to maybe getting out there if that does happen. Of course, watch it. The final is now going to be Mexico-Panama. And then USA-Canada in the third place game. The Soccer OG Podcast. Check out where all podcasts are available. Listen to the entire library at your leisure whenever you have some time. New shows with great guests coming out every week, including here, thanks to Brian Sciarretta. Next week, a regular time, as we will delve into. I don't know what we're going to delve into. It depends on what happens on the world stage. But we'll delve into that. Check out the Soccer OG on YouTube under my name, Max Bretos, for all the latest videos. You can see me in my incredible fashion awareness. We'll leave it for that. We'll see you soon again. Until then, Placido Domingo.